Okay, 2 o'clock, time to get going again. Everybody can hear me? Yep, I think we're good. Okay, so what I'm going to do today for the next hour or so is I think it's 2 weeks ago tomorrow, I gave a talk for a conference, and I don't know the name of the conference, and maybe Tricia, if you have it, you could put it in the chat, that was organized and hosted by Dr. David Brownstein. There was a whole lot of speakers there. It was a live conference, but I gave my talk virtually. And the talk was billed, it was about 50 minutes or so, and it was billed as something to the effect of why there's no pathogenic viruses, and then what makes us sick. And let's say, unfortunately, I'm not sure that's quite the right word, but I didn't get to the second part of the talk, so I ended with why there are no pathogenic, or how we know there are no pathogenic viruses. So that was part one. And then I promised the participants and the people who are watching this that I would record part two within 3 weeks. And so this is 2 weeks later because we had the conference, so I didn't quite get to it. So this is the part two of that talk. I'm not sure if there is even any way to access part one, but people who've heard me was very similar to a lot of what you've heard in other places. So I'm not sure you need to go do that. And just to summarize very briefly, because I don't want to go into this too much, basically I looked at how do we know there's a virus, and then show that it causes disease. And the three pillars of modern virology, that is the so-called isolation of the virus from cell cultures, the pictures on the electron microscope of the alleged virus, and then the sequencing of the entire genome, all turn out to be illogical, irrational, and anti-scientific. And I laid out the arguments for how I knew that, and the proof that none of those three conditions of modern virology, or the so-called proofs they use, have all been disproven, particularly by Stefan Lenka's new experiments, but even going back till 1954. And because of that, that means there is no SARS-CoV-2. That means there is no engineered or laboratory-created virus. That means there's no variants. That means there's no vaccine-induced immunity to a virus that has not been shown to exist. It also means there is no natural immunity to a virus that has not been shown to exist. This means there is no such thing as pathogenic priming. There's no such thing as antibody-dependent enhancement. There's no reason for masks. There's no reason for social distancing. There are no cancer-causing viruses such as SV40. There is no virus like HIV or chronic fatigue virus that causes either of those diseases. There is no reason to inject people with toxins or gene therapies, otherwise called vaccines. And finally, there's really no need for virologists. So I won't go through all that again. For anybody who's interested, I've been over this a lot, and you could maybe even watch that first video. So today I'm going to turn my attention, as I like to say, to something controversial, because in some ways the first thing is not controversial. It's just easy to follow observations and facts. And I'm sure you've heard me bristle at Tom has a theory, or Tom and Andy have a theory, or Tom and Stefan and Andy have a theory. We don't have any theories. We just have an explanation of the observations and facts. But today I want to turn my attention to, so if it isn't viruses that make us sick, then what does make us sick? And I promised that I would spend the second part of this talk talking about that. So here we go. I just want to say it really will help if you have purged yourself of the virus delusion in order to hear this part, because otherwise people tend to be confused. So in the way I look at it, in order to answer this question, it helps to start by just asking another very simple question, which is, how is a human being, or essentially any animal or other living being, what are we made of? What do we consist of? Now, over the last couple of years, I've asked a lot of people this question. And of course, I got a lot of interesting answers. Some of them are, well, we're made from cells, or we're made from DNA expressing itself. Or some people say we're made of light, or we're made of water, or we're spiritual beings, or we're energies that have condensed and are having a human experience or experience in the physical world. And other people say we're just a bunch of substance that just somehow cut together and creates a human being. Now, I can say that even though I was going to say all of those obviously have some validity, although not the we're just a bunch of substance one, but forget about that one for a minute. But that's not where I want to start with this. And again, some of you may have heard me talk about this, but here's how I would start so that we get agreement. When I think about what is a human being made of, my answer is we have a head and we have eyes and we have a nose. I have a pretty big nose. We have a mouth. We have ears. We have hands, fingers, fingernails. Most of us have some hair. We have a chest. We have legs, feet, toenails, and all the other things that you can see. Now, the question is, obviously, how do I know that? And the answer is pretty simple, because I can see it in myself and I can see it in every other single human being I've ever experienced. Now, somebody may say, well, I've seen human beings without fingernails or without hands or something. And of course, that is probably true, but we all know those are exceptions, and that's not, we all have an agreement. Human being is made of those things I mentioned and more. The other thing I would say about this is, if you go into studying what other cultures and particularly other sciences and other systems of medicine, like Chinese medicine, Ayurvedic medicine, Native American medicine, homeopathic medicine, herbal medicine, et cetera, as far as I can tell, they would all agree with that statement. There's a general and uniform agreement that we have all those parts that make up a human being. So now let's go deeper. What's inside, let's say, the chest or even the head? So let's take the chest. So we have blood vessels, we have nerves, we have muscles, we have a heart, and we have lungs, and in the abdomen, we have intestines and kidneys and pancreas and a bunch of other things. Generally speaking, we refer to these as organs. We don't necessarily refer to the blood vessels as organs, but I think everybody knows what I mean. So again, we have to ask ourselves the question, how do we know that this is true? And I would submit that there's a bunch of ways that we know that's true. For instance, I've been part of surgeries and I've seen people cut open and we see a heart inside that living human being. We see lungs, we see a diaphragm, blood vessels, etc. Now, I would also say that, in fairness, because as Stefan appropriately points out, and by the way, anybody who really wants to know the history of virology, would do well to watch Stefan Lenka's talk that he gave for our recent True Healing Conference. And maybe Tricia or somebody could put a link so that people could actually figure out how to get the download. Again, Stefan points out that the first responsibility of every scientist is to prove themselves wrong. And so you have to do everything in your power to say, to demonstrate that what you're seeing is not either an artifact or has some is somehow caused by the technique that you're using to see what you're seeing. You also have to be clear, as often happens in virology, that what you're seeing is not some perceptual error. So it could be that the reason you see a heart in a person who's undergoing an operation, say on their heart, is that you have given the person anesthesia and somehow the anesthesia creates this human heart, which wasn't there in the normal living, walking, breathing, moving human being. And so in a sense, the heart wasn't there when we were normal, and it's only there as a result of the anesthesia. That is possible. I would submit, though, it's highly implausible. First of all, it doesn't really make any sense. Second of all, you can also see a heart without doing any anesthesia at all. So you have a sort of control. You can see it with an ultrasound. You can see it with a CT scan. You can see it with a chest X-ray. You can see it with an MRI. You can even, to a certain extent, feel that there's something that feels a little bit like it might be a heart, which correlates with what you're seeing in the living person who's cut open. And so I think we can 100% discount that it's the anesthesia that produced the heart and the lungs and all the rest of the tissue, and that the heart and all the other organs actually are real and exist and are what a human being is made of. Now, again, using the same sort of thinking and logic as our first example, as far as I can tell, every medical system, every system of science prior to modern medicine has not only believed in the existence of these organs, but actually put great stock in them. So Chinese medicine talks about health as a reflection of the energy flow through the heart and the lungs and the liver and the kidneys and the spleen and all the other organs, as does Ayurvedic medicine. They often say the pulses are reflective of what's happening in the organs. And all that to say, as far as I know, there has never been any system of thought in science or medicine that did not agree with the idea that we are made of organs, and even that the organs have a prime function in health and illness. Okay, so far, so good. Now let's take one of those organs, let's just say the liver, and say, so what is the liver made of? And here's where it gets interesting, because most people that I've asked, I'd say 98%, say, well, the liver is made of cells. And what they mean by that is the liver is a organ, which you can feel, palpate, see on X-rays, and it's divided into these little cubicles, and each one of them is separate from the other, although they have a certain connection. And those are called hepatocytes, otherwise known as liver cells. And so a liver is made of liver cells. Now, when I say here's where it gets interesting, I say that because if I then ask people the question, have you ever seen a liver cell in a living person with in their liver? And the answer is no. Now, it could be because we don't have the technique, we don't have the microscopic power, but you cannot put an instrument, any microscope or optical device, and have the power to see liver cells in a living or even anesthetized person's liver. what you have to do is take a piece of the liver and cut it into very thin slices. And then you have to stain it and put these toxic dyes. And then you have to shine a high light on it. And then you can see these compartments called liver cells. Now, here, it's not quite as obvious that staining a tissue may not produce an artifact that we would look like compartments under a two-dimensional slide. Now, just to be clear, I'm not saying it's proof that liver cells or any cells do or don't exist. I'm just saying that if you want to use the process of killing something, removing it from its nutritive and energetic base or system, and then putting it in toxic dyes and stains, and then shining a high light on it, that you better prove that none of those steps somehow made a compartmentalization happen in that liver tissue. Because after all, we know that when you threaten bacteria and fungus, we know from the Biggleson brothers' lecture at that same conference we had last week, there is something called pleomorphism, and you can see bacteria become spores. We can see metamorphosis in front of our very eyes. So we actually have precedent that tissue can form compartments when it's poisoned or threatened. And so that doesn't prove that there were cells while it was in the normal, living, freely moving state. And I'm not saying it proves that they don't exist either. But what's interesting, and here I should have said something in the beginning, a lot of what I'm talking about here comes from the work of two people who I consider the best biologist of all time, and that are Gilbert Ling and Harold Hillman. And I would say to all scientists and doctors who may be watching this, that if you haven't read literally hundreds or thousands of pages of Hillman and Ling, and they also have YouTube, so you can see it that way on video, then you have missed out on some of the fundamental tenets of biology, because they go through these issues that I'm going through in great detail. And they talk about over and over again the fact that if you want to claim that something exists, you need to show that it wasn't the dye that caused it to form. You need to show that it wasn't the removal of the tissue from its living matrix that caused some changes to happen, which may throw you off in what you're seeing. The other fact that Hillman talks about many times is the fact that there are now widely considered to be 188 approximately different tissue types in a human being. So we're talking about mesentery and ovaries and the lens of the eye and the heart and the kidneys, et cetera. These are all different tissues. 44 of them, to be exact, are considered what are called syncytium. A syncytium is essentially an organized structure that has no internal divisions. So it's a homogeneous structure. In other words, like the lens of the eye has no cellular component. And if you think about it, why would the liver break itself into little compartments called cells, like some office cubicle? Wouldn't it be easier and stronger and better communication if it too remained as a syncytium, which is a somehow organized tissue that has not necessarily made it or not made itself into internal divisions? So at this point, we have this question, do these cells really exist? We know in 44 tissue types, they don't. It doesn't make any sense to divide the lens of your eye, whose function is to be transparent to the light, into compartments that would apparently blur the light. Now, the other thing that's interesting about the whole cellular theory is if we apply the same reasoning that we did to the first two, what we find is that no system of science or medicine until the modern materialistic science actually believed in the existence of cells. There is no mention of cells that I know of in Chinese medicine, Ayurvedic medicine, Greek medicine. I'm not sure about that one, but as far as I know, there isn't, or Native American medicine. They never talked about anything like cells. Now, obviously, that could be because they didn't have microscopes and they couldn't see them, but it could be that they were not interested or not believing that such a thing was either necessary or could be possible. And it turns out that the whole cellular theory of makeup of the human being came from a guy, like a lot of these things. The guy's name was Rudolf Virchow. Again, Stefan Lenke, in his talk on our conference, the True Healing Conference, went through the history of what got Virchow to postulate that a human being is made of cells and that all diseases start in cells, for which he had essentially no evidence for at the time, and for which, interestingly, he was roundly criticized for coming up with such an anti-scientific proposition back, we're talking 150 plus years ago. But somehow that became the dogma. And so now we all believe it, even though most of us don't even know who came up with the theory or on what evidence it was based on. So again, just to be clear, I don't by any means say that this proves in the 140 some tissues that they're not divided into cells, but I think we should think about that and actually do experimentation and try to prove ourselves right or wrong with the appropriate control experiments. And if you want to see how to do that, just read Harold Hillman, because he was the master. But now let's get deeper than that. Sorry. And right now I'm going to assume that there are cells. So even though I threw some doubt on that, let's assume that there are cells and ask ourselves the question, so what is inside a cell? And here I'm going to try to screen share again. And I'm getting pretty proficient at this. Except I started in the wrong place. And I'm going to start this part with one of my favorite quotes from one of my favorite people, although I never met him, Mark Twain. It ain't what you don't know that gets you into trouble. It's what you know for sure that just ain't so. And that's what we're dealing with. So what is in a cell? You could take pretty much any cell. And here is a diagram of what a cell is made of. I think you can see my cursor. The first thing I will point out is, like computer-generated images of viruses, this is obviously not a real cell. It is a picture that somebody drew. And it has the cell membrane, and it has many other parts. It has a nucleus, it has ribosomes, cytoplasm, microtubules, which means small tubes, endoplasmic reticulum, lysosomes, that's this, Golgi apparatus, mitochondria. And again, for those of you who are really interested in what I'm about to say and want to go deeper, you must read 1,000 pages of Harold Hillman and watch his YouTube videos, because he explains the history of each of these organelles or subcellular components, which means the components inside the cell. So let's just take one example, the ribosome. And one of the reasons I use this example is because it's interesting to talk about, for one thing. And the other reason is because it's integral to the whole genetic theory and the whole mRNA theory. Because the function of the ribosome, we're told, is to translate, meaning convert, the messenger RNA, mRNA, into proteins. Essentially, we are living proteins. And so there has to be a place where the mRNA, which is made from the DNA, is made into these proteins, and lo and behold, it's the ribosomes. So if there's doubt about the existence of a ribosome, then by definition, the whole genetic thesis starts to break down. So what about these ribosomes? So every picture you will ever see of ribosomes, here they are. Some of them are coating the endoplasmic reticulum. That means it's a rough endoplasmic reticulum. They are perfect circles, like this, like this, like this. And I will show you some pictures in a minute. Now, let's be clear about another thing. When you look at a cell, you can't see any of these organelles, these subcellular fractions, unless under a light microscope, basically, except mitochondria, which I'll show you. So you have to use an electron microscope. To get a picture of an electron microscope, and there is a newer way now, but the traditional way that's been going on for 80 years, when most of these things were found, involves a number of processes. For one, you take a tissue and you put it in a blender, i.e. you macerate it. And then often you put it in some sort of an enzyme bath. And then you often freeze it, sometimes to 50 or 100 degrees below zero Celsius. And then you stain it with heavy metals. And I know now they just freeze it, and they don't always use the heavy metals. And then you put it in an electron beam, which immediately evaporates the water. And then you see a two-dimensional picture on your slide. And there are some other processes involved too. Now, if I asked all of you, do you think I could tell what your hand is made of and what your hand does if I, A, cut your hand off the body, put it in an enzyme bath, froze it to 150 degrees, macerated it, and then shot an electron beam at it, put it in a heavy metal staining dye, and then I see a picture of it, and now I'm going to tell you what your hand is made of, what it looks like, and what it does. If I said that, you would probably think I was crazy. But that's where we saw all these things. Now, if you realize that every picture of a ribosome, there was a maceration of the tissue step, and you also realize that if you see a perfect sphere on a perfect circle, on a two-dimensional image, it must be a sphere in real life. And then I would ask you, what are the chances that if you put a perfect sphere like an orange in a blender, that every piece of the orange would be a perfect circle? And hopefully your answer would be none of them. No chance. So here's what you see in an electron microscope. These are all ribosomes. They're basically all more or less perfect circles. Here you see the ribosomes coating the endoplasmic reticulum, which I'll get to in a minute. So you see these perfect sphere, perfect circles, which must represent perfect spheres. And yet we know that there is no chance of macerating a tissue and having every piece of it be a perfect sphere. It simply doesn't obey the laws of geometry. So we have doubts that these ribosomes even exist. Now, Hillman did some experiments using tissue that had, or proteins or other starting material that had no chance of being ribosomes, and he put it through the same process, and he found that when any tissue is dying, sometimes there are always gas bubbles that evolve. They are always perfect spheres. They always pick up the heavy metal stain, and on an electron microscope, they always look like perfect circles. And so if you trace back the history of the ribosome, you will come to the conclusion that this is what we call an artifact. everything you see in an electron microscope is an artifact, which means it doesn't actually exist in real life anywhere near what, like what it is being seen in this picture. And that it's very likely, if not proven, that a ribosome is only a gas bubble that is evolving because you dehydrated, poison starved, and that's what happens when tissue is dying. Now, let's look at another one of these structures, and you can do the same sort of thinking process, the same argument with each of these structures. So here's the endoplasmic reticulum, which is a tube that is open to the nucleus. This is the nucleus. So it's open here, and then it goes like this, like a snake, and then it opens. It should be open here to the outside of the cell. Now, why did they, quote, invent the endoplasmic reticulum? Because there was a problem. The theory of genetics is the DNA, which is the molecule of life, the code of life, that is located inside the nucleus. It makes its RNA, mRNA, in a process called transcription, inside the nucleus. And then it gets outside of the nucleus, goes to the ribosomes, sometimes on the endoplasmic reticulum, where it gets translated into protein. All very elegant and clear theory. But here's the problem. You can measure the pH with a little pipette or probe in the cytoplasm and in the nucleus, and you can measure that they're different. Now, the pH comes from the concentration of hydrogen ions. Hydrogen ions are probably amongst the smallest physical thing, maybe the smallest physical thing there is, thousands of times smaller than a mRNA. So here's the problem. How does the mRNA get out of the nucleus without the hydrogen ions equilibrating through the same exit point? Essentially, what we have is a problem of how do you make a door that's big enough for an elephant to get out, and yet it will also keep mosquitoes out? Because the only way there can be a difference in the pH here than here, cytoplasm and nucleus, is if the hydrogen ions can't freely diffuse from one compartment to the other. And so we know they can't. And how can there be a door that's big enough for something thousands of times bigger to get out and not let the smaller thing in? So that's one problem. The second problem is if you look at living cells, cells that are not stained or dyed and are still living under certain kinds of microscopes, you see that the nucleus often does 360 rotations. Now, again, if you realize that this endoplasmic reticulum is essentially a rope, and there's more than just two of them, that's tethering the nucleus to the cell wall. And if you think this is going to keep rotating, this whole thing would get all tangled up, and there's no possible way you could see an easily observable phenomena called nuclear rotation. And all that, and 100 other pages of the history of the finding of the endoplasmic reticulum in Hillman, make you come to the conclusion that this is an artifact because of the freezing and staining process. And here you see it. These are essentially fracture lines in the cytoplasm that pick up stain, and then the bubbles coalesce on them, which is a commonly observed phenomena. And there is no exit from the nucleus that's attaching to the cell wall. And this endoplasmic reticulum that you see here is simply an artifact. And again, I don't want to take up all the time going over this, but you can see this with every single organelle or subcellular component. And let me just mention one more thing quickly, because it's not just the subcellular components or the components of a cell, which must be questioned, but something like a synapse in a nerve. Now, we all have heard of synapses. It's a central part of our basic understanding of neurology and how nerves function. We have neurons with their cell body, and then they have an axon, and then they end in a synapse, which has a little vesicle, and a chemical is released. And then there's essentially a moat or a synapse, a junction, and it crosses, the chemical crosses the synapse, attaches to the receptor on the other side. And many of our drugs and therapies work on this receptor. So I went looking this past few days, can I see a picture of the receptor? And here's what I found. Now, I could be gaming the system and you could find a lot of them, but I don't think so, because I couldn't find anything that shows me an actual synapse. Or how about this? But this is obviously not a real synapse. And you could say, well, it's too small to see. So then I looked for an electron microscope picture, and what I got was this. So apparently this is the proof right here that there are synapses. And all I can say is that doesn't look like any synapse to me. So again, Hillman goes through what you find when you dissect actual nerves. And you don't find anything like synapses. And it's very possible, even likely, that the synapses are created because of the inevitable occurrence when you dehydrate the tissue, it pulls together, and then you get these vesicles which pick up the heavy metal stain. And unfortunately, that's what we call synapses. And I'll just mention a final one, because it's not even, this is one of the favorites of the so-called anti-vax community, and you hear about this a lot. And so it's not just confined to structures, we're also talking about functions. So we hear a lot about the blood-brain barrier. So apparently what we mean is there's blood, and I assume you mean blood vessels. And at the blood vessels in the brain, there's some barrier like cellophane or something that keeps the contents of the blood from getting into the brain like it would in the liver. So I went looking for a picture of the blood vessels and the connection in the liver, which is what this is. So here's a blood vessel. This is a bigger blood vessel, little blood vessels. There is no barrier. Okay, so we know there's no blood-liver barrier, at least that you can see on a light microscope. So here's a picture of the brain. We see blood vessels. There's no barrier. Now, maybe it's too small and we have to see it with an electron microscope. I went looking and I didn't see it. So we have to question that, whether there is a blood-brain barrier. I would love to see a picture of something, an anatomical structure called a barrier, because I don't see it. So the question then, what does this have to do with why we get sick, is what are we actually made of? What can we prove? And here is all you can really see. And again, Ling and Hillman go into this in great detail. You see a very smooth cell membrane like this. There are no receptors in the cell membrane, no ACE2 receptors sticking out of the membrane. All the pictures you will see of that are drawings. There's no evidence that this is a lipid bilayer. It is a smooth, probably fat soluble, but maybe just highly organized water membrane. And then you see here, very organized, coherent, structured, or what Ling calls polarized water, which is what the cytoplasm is. And then you do in fact see mitochondria, which make ATP, which have nothing to do with energy. That is another myth that unfortunately is propagated. And I can get into at some point what exactly ATP does, because essentially what it does is it binds to the proteins, unfolds them, and allows this structuring of the water to occur, which then forms the cytoplasm, and the structured water creates voltage, which is what gives us life. And then you do see a nucleus with a vaguely defined membrane around it. And that's it. No ribosomes, no lipid bilayer membrane, no endoplasmic reticulum, no lysosomes, no Golgi apparatus, no astrocytes, no synapses in nerves, no receptors in cell membranes, no sodium-potassium pump. There are no pumps in this membrane. ATP is not a source of energy. It plays the role that heat does with Jell-O. It unfolds the proteins and allows the water structuring to occur. There are no cristae in mitochondria. There's no blood-brain barrier as an anatomical structure. And DNA is not a double helix. That one we'll have to go to another time. So if you realize that this is the system that we're dealing with, then it immediately gives you a unified theory of how disease comes about. Because all we have is an ATP, which has to do with structuring the water, organelle, organized, coherent water, and a nucleus, which has genetic material in it, which I would submit functions like an antenna. So the way to think of this system is we're essentially talking like about a radio. And the radio is represented by the water structure. That is the physical structure. The radio downloads information of what sort? Energies, frequencies, love, emotions, wavelengths, sound, thought. All the different electromagnetic frequencies, wavelengths, sound, light. Light is very important. The nucleic acids take this and they create this very special structured water called DNA water that diffuses into the cytoplasm. And then without any other code needed, but just the presence of these nucleic acids for energy and for their antenna, they create the proteins which create the living being. And that's all there is to it. And so this immediately makes sense of all of the history of natural medicine. If you have toxins, glyphosate, bad emotions, aluminum, mercury dissolved in your gel, your radio is out of tune and you will make the wrong kind of proteins. Your body can't tolerate that. So it will do the only thing it can to essentially dissolve the gel. That's called a fever. And then it will flush out the contents. And that's called mucus and barfing and coughing and diarrhea. And that's why every natural medicine system used fever therapy. Hippocrates said, give me a medicine to produce a fever and I can treat and cure any disease, because he was aware apparently of this system, energy downloaded by the watery crystal that produces an outcome. And the reason we're made of water crystals is because water with its DNA antenna can download any kind of information in the form of wavelengths and thought. And it can also download toxic information in the form of electromagnetic frequencies like Wi-Fi and radio signals and radar, et cetera. So every therapy, the Gerson therapy, sweat lodges, saunas, all can be seen out of this one model. You can see the problem with a cataract in your eye, that is a pure water crystal, and you put abnormal electromagnetic frequencies like a computer, and you eat toxic food and drink toxic water, and you can't flush them out because it's a crystal structure in your eye. And so it starts precipitating, and that's what we call a cataract. You see the same thing happening in your knee. You get the water loses its structure. it no longer forms this negatively charged gel, which is what lines the joints and creates this electromagnetic repulsion, which allows for free movement and a sort of cushioning. And then we have bone on bone, and we call that osteoarthritis. And when you get to the subject of people say, so what causes measles or chickenpox? You have to start with the facts, which is that children are growing, maturing beings. And the reason we're made of water and not quartz is because the water can grow and evolve as we become more perfect crystals. That essentially is the game we're playing. So what happens with measles is there some sort of universal toxin or situation, maybe electromagnetic frequencies, maybe a chemical. And for many, many children, it's impacting the integrity of their crystal, and the body wants to get rid of it. So it does the fever to dissolve the gel. It sends it out through the mucus and the complex spots or the rash on the skin. It communicates that through some sort of bioresonance to other children, that now we have the opportunity to do what is not a disease, but a maturation step, which is exactly why every study that looks at what happens to children who get measles is they're better for life. Less cancer, less diabetes, less osteoarthritis, less ADD, less mental illness. If you poison them with a product otherwise known as a vaccine, you will inhibit their ability to go through the maturation step, and you will make them, in every single case you poison a child with the toxic results of a cell culture, otherwise known as a measles shot, and you make it so they're unable to go through this maturation step, and you will be able to prove that they have more diseases, chronic diseases that I just mentioned, in their entire life. This same pattern is across every culture and happens with every single so-called vaccination. You inhibit the maturation process and you cut off in some way the communication between organisms that say, now is a good time to go through this maturation process. It's harmless. We can do this. And you stop that and you end up with people who are essentially misfits because they can no longer be on this journey of purifying their gels, which is essentially the entire game that we're playing. Now, let me just finish here by saying, can water do all these things I just said? Is water able to make these proteins? So here's an interesting way of looking at it. This was the work of a friend of mine. It's also, she was a speaker at our last conference, Veda Austin, and she has developed the technique of giving impulses like picture or word or something to water and then freezing it and looking at the picture it forms. Now, I will remind you that in a living organism, the water is working with proteins. In this scenario, the water is working with what it has, which is to form pictures out of crystals. So in this case, she presented a petri dish of water with a wedding invitation and said, show me the wedding invitation. Puts the petri dish in the freezer. A few minutes later, takes it out, and the water creates an image of a wedding ring. Now, if you think about it, again, it can't sing Here Comes the Bride, because the water doesn't have a vocal cord or a voice box. In us, it has the ability to make proteins. In this, it has the ability to make pictures. So it uses its intelligence and its creativity in an almost mind-blowing way to show us an amazing picture of what a wedding invitation might look like. And then I'll just let you think about this. She asks the water, "So what is falling down?" Now think about that for a minute. And the water says, everybody knows, London Bridge is falling down. And so here you get a glimpse of the creativity and the memory and the intelligence of water that is the basis of our of this system. And once you see what we're made of and how this system works, it is very easy to understand the entirety of Chinese medicine. They're not working with cells or cell pathology. They're working with the energetic input into the water. When you're detoxing, when you're doing coffee enemas, when you're doing the Gerson diet, when you're getting a bacterial infection to clean out, so-called infection to clean out the debris, when you're doing a sweat lodge, hyperthermia, suddenly the whole world of medicine begins to make sense. Now, finally, am I the only person who's ever thought of this? Obviously, no. Here is a very well-known geneticist, Dr. Maiwan Ho. Here's what she says. Organisms are so dynamically coherent at the molecular level that they appear to be crystalline. There is a dynamic liquid crystalline continuum of connective tissue and extracellular matrix linking directly into the equally liquid crystalline cytoplasm in the interior of every cell in the body. Every part is in communication with every other part through a dynamic, tunable, responsive liquid crystal medium that pervades the whole body from organs and tissues to the interior of every cell. And I would add, it can communicate with other liquid crystals and say, now it's the time to do measles or chickenpox or the so-called flu, which exactly explains transmission in a situation where there is no virus to be found. And every single contagion study done has shown that these particles can transmit nothing. Here's Dr. Sven Gorky, Nobel Prize in Medicine for, I think, vitamin C. The molecular structure of water is the essence of all life. The man who can control that structure in cellular systems will change the world. That's the COVID play, is trying to control with toxic things like graphene and nanoparticles the very crystalline structure of our water. Here's Dr. Marcel Vogel, senior scientist for IBM and the world's foremost expert on crystals. Apparently, he invented things like the plasma TV and other things. What we have found in our laboratory is that the entry of the mind projected through a crystal will structure water just like it was frozen into ice. The remarkable and unique differentiation is that water, when it is structured with mind and thought, remains fluid but structured. That type of category is called a liquid crystal, a mesophase, a mesomorphic transition. And now you can all see why thoughts and feelings and emotions, all of which get essentially embedded into this liquid crystal or mesophase and change it slightly, can actually cause illness or be the healer. Why tuning forks? Why light, etc.? We even know from the editor of Physical Science, cell water is generally different than bulk water. It becomes more like bulk in cancer cells. So normally we have crystalline water. In cancer, the structure cannot be maintained and it becomes like liquid water. And that is what we call disease. And this is even the basis of all spiritual traditions that have ever been. In Genesis, before God created earth, plants, or people, he creates water. The only thing that precedes water is light. So that's exactly the system I'm talking about. There's light and there's sound gets downloaded into the water to create the human being. Then Jesus answered, "Very truly, I tell you, no one can enter the kingdom of God unless they are born of water and spirit, exactly the two components. The Quran says we have created every living thing from water. The Upanishads say the whole universe is made of water. All beings are made up of water. The vital airs are the effects of water. Cows, the effects of water. Food, kingdoms, cosmos, Vedic meters, all are made up of water. Water is truth, and all the deities are water. All the worlds are made up of water. And thank you very much for listening. I hope I've addressed the question, why do we get sick? Why does there appear to be transmission? And for more information and some amazing lectures on many of the details, I would go to our True Healing Conference website. You can download about 10 talks that all go through this in various forms. And those of you who are scientists and doctors, and if you want to do yourself a real favor, read Gilbert Ling and Harold Hillman. And then I'd love to hear from everybody. So take care, and I will see you next week.